Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 32 of the Avatar podcast. I am your host, Albert, or Nantikamea. So today, we are going to be discussing the press kit, and specifically the production notes, hence the name of this episode, Making a Masterpiece. So I go way back in terms of production notes. The gift of them, really, is that they provide these are pretty extensive, but 10 to 15 minutes worth of just purely beautifully outlined notes on the making of a project. The history of these goes truly way back. There's been production notes made, official production notes created for every major film. And one of my earliest memories was accessing the special features of early DVDs. And as soon as I saw the production notes, that's it. I would get myself a drink and a snack, and I would page over with my little DVD remote and read every single page. They're not as easily findable on things like Blu-ray and such, but that doesn't matter because hopefully, let's go. Awa willing, definitely. Production notes are going to make a comeback in the forthcoming films. I have so many thoughts, obviously, on where we're at currently, less than 10 days out from the release of the film. But to stay on track, I will start reading them. They're from the press kit, which you can find just by looking for Avatar: The Way of Water press kit. So for Twister, I read them back in the day, for Jurassic Park. And honestly, think of any film that you truly love and that you would love to read the official production notes of, and just do a keyword Google search. I recently did a sweep of them, Wizarding World ones. I kind of read, Philosopher's Stone, etc. You just go production notes, and it's this wonderfully laid out chronicle and sort of a capturing of the production of a project. So I was so pleasantly surprised to see that right there, easily available within the press kit. And so I'm very excited to read these. I haven't actually read these yet, so let's go. Avatar: The Way of Water. Production notes. 13 years ago, Academy Award winner James Cameron introduced moviegoers to a world unlike any they've ever seen with his breathtaking epic Avatar. Now, the visionary filmmaker is inviting audiences on a brand new cinematic journey with the highly anticipated Avatar: The Way of Water. Sam Worthington and Zoe Saldana reprised their iconic roles, playing Jake Sully and Neytiri, now loving parents doing everything they can to keep their family together. When unforeseen events displace them from their home, the Sullys travel across the vast reaches of the moon Pandora, ultimately fleeing to territory held by the Metkayina clan, who live in harmony with their surrounding oceans. There, the Sullys must learn to navigate both the dangerous water world and the uncomfortable dynamics of gaining acceptance from their new community. In addition to Worthington and Saldana, the film stars Academy Award nominee Sigourney Weaver, Stephen Lang, Cliff Curtis, and Academy Award winner Kate Winslet. The movie also introduces audiences to a group of talented young actors, including Brighton Dalton, Jamie Flatters, Trinity Jolie Bliss, Jack Champion, and Bailey Bass. The screenplay was written by James Cameron and Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver, from a story by James Cameron and Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver and Josh Friedman and Jane Salerno. Cameron and John Landau are the film's producers, with David Valdez and Richard Bainham serving as executive producers. Cameron's below-the-line team includes production designers Dylan Cole and Ben Proctor, Academy Award-winning director of photography Russell Carpenter, ASC, and Academy Award-winning costume designer Deborah L. Scott, with music by Simon Franklin. Editors are Stephen Rifkin, ACE, David Brenner, ACE, John Rafua, ACE, and James Cameron, ACE. Senior visual effects supervisor is Academy Award winner Joe Letteri. Academy Award winner Richard Bainham serves as Lightstorm's visual effects supervisor and virtual second unit director, a Lightstorm Entertainment production. A generational family epic playing out against the brilliant colors and the majesty of an expanded Pandoran landscape, Avatar: The Way of Water premieres exclusively in theaters December 16, 2022. Inside the Story. Making a sequel to the most successful movie of all time is a daunting challenge, but if anyone could do it, it would be James Cameron, who has before written and directed two of the most successful and beloved sequels of all time, Aliens and Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Avatar was a world that had been with Cameron for a long time. He had written an early treatment for the original film in 1994, even though the means to realize his vision did not yet exist. Embarking on the production more than a decade later, the trailblazing filmmaker brought the wealth of knowledge he had amassed on the sets of his earlier triumphs, including such unforgettable blockbusters as Titanic, The Terminator, T2, Aliens, True Lies, and The Abyss, to Avatar, creating a live-action film that transformed motion capture into performance capture and pushed visual effects technology to a new and astonishing frontier. Yet, at every turn, Cameron took care to ensure that the revolutionary technology invented for the movie never overwhelmed the performances and emotion of the characters or the sweep of the story. Given all they had achieved with Avatar, and with the idea of sequels beginning to percolate in their heads, Cameron and his longtime producing partner John Landau took the unusual step of convening the key below-the-line principals who had helped realize the film for a technology summit. In February of 2010, they all met at Santa Barbara, California Hotel, to review what aspects of the filmmaking process had worked best, and what they could have perhaps improved upon. The gathering yielded a trove of insights, which Cameron mulled as he contemplated a future on Pandora. "I don't think that Avatar: The Way of Water would have been possible if we hadn't done that exercise," Cameron says now. Once he decided to explore further stories set on the lush alien moon, Cameron sat down and began writing a plethora of ideas. With more than 1,500 pages of notes and story beats, Cameron and Landau realized that there was more than one story to tell. They brought on an elite group of top Hollywood screenwriters to work with Cameron in transforming his story notes into the four films that would continue the adventures of Jake, Neytiri, and the new family they created together. There was no shortage of ideas, and the process took months to hone in on the exact stories for not just one sequel, but for a series of subsequent movies, all highly ambitious, yet all anchored around one central theme: the importance of family. Says Landau, "I tell people that Jim writes movies with themes that are bigger than their genre, and that's why his movies resonate with people. And there's no greater theme, universally, than family." The filmmaker wanted to make all the screenplays for all the follow-ups completed before moving on to production. "We had to write four movies before I could start on the first sequel," Cameron says. "I wanted to map out all the stories and then get the economy of scale of capturing the actors across multiple films, and then filming the live action. The thinking was we could consolidate the different stages of production together, performance capture, live action, and post-production." Heroic Jake Sully, having begun Avatar as a paraplegic marine grieving the death of his twin brother and desperately searching for a new path, now begins The Way of Water as the happily married patriarch of his family and the head of the Omatikaya clan, fully inhabiting his Na'vi body. "Family is our fortress," he often reminds wife Neytiri and their children, Neteyam, Jamie Flatters, Lo'ak, Brian Dalton, Took, Trinity Jolie Bliss, and adopted teenage daughter, Kiri, Sigourney Weaver. Much to Jake's and Neytiri's chagrin, their kids often hang out with Spider, Jack Champion, a human child orphaned by the war, and too small at the time to return to Earth. The Omatikaya clan has lived a rather idyllic life for more than a decade before growing a star in the night sky signals. The Omatikaya clan has lived a rather idyllic life for more than a decade before a growing star in the night sky signals the return of the human invaders. When human forces and massive destructive equipment land on Pandora, the Sullies and the rest of the Omatikaya are forced to create a secure stronghold in a giant cavern located with one of the massive floating rock formations that are part of the Hallelujah Mountains. The Sky People returned to Pandora not just to run a mining operation to strip the moon of the valuable material known as unobtainium. Instead, the Resources Development Administration, the RDA, returns in force with the added objective to colonize the entire moon and make it the new home for humanity, as Earth is on the precipice of no longer being inhabitable. Destroying a large swathe of forest, the RDA erects a giant walled city on the ocean's edge called Bridgehead. Leading the RDA's on-world assets is unyielding General Francis Ardmore, played by Edie Falco. In addition to having an armada of weaponized land, air, and sea vehicles at their disposal, the RDA has brought with them a secret weapon, an elite team of soldiers resurrected as recombinants, RECOMs. RECOMs are autonomous avatars embedded with the memories of the humans whose DNA was used to create them. Leading this fighting force is RECOM Colonel Miles Quaritch, Stephen Lang. As the Olo-Ektan leader of the Omatikaya, Jake successfully leads the warriors of the clan onto incursions against the RDA. However, when Jake realizes that he himself is in fact the target of Quaritch's RECOM team, he and Neytiri make the tough decision that it is in the best interest of the greater clan for the Sullies to flee their homeland and seek safe haven in the distant atolls of Pandora. The decision is one that tears at the heart of each of the family members. That's the dilemma of those characters, Cameron says. To do what's right for the greater good, or to do your job and your duty of what your heart tells you for your family. After making the long journey across the vast oceans of Pandora, the Sullies arrive at the home of the Metcaina clan, led by Ronal, Kate Winslet, and Tonawari, Cliff Curtis. There, Jake invokes Uturu, a Na'vi tradition stating that any refugee seeking sanctuary must be granted safe harbor. Reluctantly welcoming their guests, Ronal and Tonawari instruct their children Sireya, Bailey Bess, and Aonung, Philip Geljo, to attempt to help the Sully kids adapt to the Water Clan's customs and traditions. The Sully's disappearance from the rainforest does not stop Quaritch from searching out the insurgent Jake Sully. When Quaritch gets intel that suggests that Jake might be living among one of the many reef clans, he turns his focus to ravaging reef village after reef village in search of his nemesis. Quaritch's pursuit leads not only to an epic sea battle that pits RDA forces against Jake, Neytiri and the Metcaina people, but also a very personal confrontation between Quaritch and the two Sully parents. With the story in place, Cameron and Landau challenged the film's key department heads to come up with methodologies and new technologies that would allow Cameron to both create even more expressive and engaging characters on the screen and to set them in a world that, despite its fantastical design, would come off as real. The result was that as production began, Cameron had at his disposal a completely new suite of technology tools. The stuff we're working with now is so advanced compared to the first film, Cameron says. Now, does that make a better movie from an audience perspective? Absolutely not. The broader audience only cares about a story, the characters, and how the film makes them feel. I keep that in mind first and foremost every single day. Landau explains that each sequel story comes to its own conclusion and emotional resolution. But when looked at as a whole, the four Avatar sequels will create an even larger connected epic saga. Rather than feeling the external pressure associated with making a sequel to a giant box office hit, the filmmakers put pressure on themselves to just make the best movies possible. There's pressure every day that you make a movie, but the pressure is the pressure that we put on ourselves. Landau says, we want to push the boundaries of storytelling and captivating audiences. All that does is make us work harder. In devoting years of his creative life to the Avatar films, Cameron says he's determined to make sure the sequels are entertaining and laden with spectacle. At the same time, they're moving and emotional. At the same time, he's imbued them with themes that are important to him, chief among them environmental stewardship and, of course, the importance of family. With Avatar and where I've chosen to take the story and open up the landscape and the characters that I've brought in and some of the questions that get asked, I don't feel there's anything that I need to say cinematically that I will not say across these four films, he says. About the characters. The Sully family. Australian actor Sam Worthington returns to the leading role of Marine-turned-Na'vi leader Jake Sully. Zoe Saldana, once again, is the Na'vi warrior Neytiri, now wrestling with her obligations and duties to her family and her clan. Sigourney Weaver plays their adopted teenage daughter Kiri, who's the biological daughter of the avatar of Dr. Grace Augustine, the deceased character Weaver played in the first film. South London native Jamie Flatters is Netea, the eldest of Jake and Neytiri's boys, and the golden child who can do no wrong. Brighton Dalton, who hails from Orange County, California, is the proverbial second son, Lo'ak. Equally desperate to win Jake's approval, Lo'ak was born with an extra finger, which makes him something of an outcast among his clan. Trinity Jolie Bliss portrays Took. She is daring, mischievous, and incredibly close to her mother, Neytiri. Her grandmother, Mo'at, C.H. Pounder, reprising her avatar role, and big sister, Kiri. Jack Champion is Spider, a human child left behind on Pandora as a toddler, to whom the Sully kids, and Kiri in particular, feel a special attachment. The Metcaina. Reuniting with James Cameron for the first time since 1997's Titanic, Academy Award winner Kate Winslet portrays Ronal, the Tzahik or shamanic matriarch of the Metcaina clan, married to Tonawari Cliff Curtis, the Olo'ektan of the clan. A New Zealander of Maori descent, actor Cliff Curtis is known for his work in such films as The Meg and The Dark Horse, and the television series Fear the Walking Dead. Also, just to double back quickly, we have this line here that says it will create an even larger connected epic saga. Rather than feeling the external pressure associated with making a sequel to a giant box office hit, the filmmakers put pressure on themselves to just make the best movie possible. All right, so this says there's pressure every day that you make a movie, but the pressure is the pressure that we make, that we put on ourselves. So the reason I'm mentioning that in the middle of talking about the Metcaina is that this new clan is being added organically. There's no attempt, I believe, and I truly feel, on the filmmaker's part, on trying to like duplicate that first experience, like one for one, of discovering the Motikaya clan. Like, this feels organic and beautiful to the story itself, and by extension, as a byproduct, we will experience this brand new clan of which Ronal and Tonawari are the leaders. So, looking forward to it. Bailey Bass plays Ronal, and Tonawari's teenage daughter, Tsireya, whose ties to her family are tested once Jake and Neytiri's middle child, Lo'ak, enters her life. Canadian-Filipino actor Philip Geljo, from The Odd Squad, plays their son, Aonung, a great hunter who treats the Sully family with wariness. And young Maori actor Dwayne Evans Jr. plays the Metcaina teen Rokto, best friend to Aonung. Quaritch. Stephen Lang returns as reconstituted Recom Quaritch. Having played the human antagonist from Avatar who died at the end of the first film, Lang returns as a recombinant, or recom, of his character. A recom is a specialized autonomous avatar embedded with memories of the human whose DNA was used to create it. Quaritch's recom possesses all the skills he had as the head of SecOps, the private security force that once defended the base of Hell's Gate, but now with the added advantage of a 9-foot-tall Na'vi body. Additional cast. Joel David Moore reprises his role of Norm Spellman, a scientist who remained behind on Pandora and feels at home with his Na'vi compatriots. C.C.H. Pounder once again portrays Mo'at, Neytiri's mother, and the Tzahik of the Omotikaya clan. Actor, musician, and filmmaker Jermaine Clement, Flight of the Conchords, What We Do in the Shadows, is Dr. Ian Garvin, a marine biologist who works for the RDA. Australian actor Brendan Cowell takes on the role of the larger-than-life captain of the Sea Dragon, Captain Mick Scoresby, a man driven by self-interest and greed. About the production. Rather than create a host of new planets and moons, James Cameron chose to continue to explore more of the moon Pandora itself with the Avatar sequels. He reasoned that the moon, which orbits a gas giant planet called Polyphemus in the Alpha Centauri A star system, could contain a range of landscapes, just like Earth. Pandora is another character in the movie, says producer John Landau. We've been using Pandora as a metaphor for our world, and we could travel our world for ages and not see all the wonders that it holds. So Jim made the decision to keep the story set on Pandora and to explore new biomes and new cultures. Based on his love for the oceans, my love for the oceans, we settled on the oceans as the next sounding ground for our stories. Cameron turned to production designer Dylan Cole to design everything related to natural Pandora and the Na'vi, with production designer Bryn Proctor
charged with focusing on its environments, vehicles and weapons, and the human characters. Usually, you have one production designer who manages everything that goes in front of the lens, Cameron says. But there were two worlds in collision in this story. The human world, which is highly technological and highly recognizable to us, and the world of Pandora, the Na'vi, the creatures, the plants, everything. Dylan and Ben weren't just designing for movie two, they were designing across the whole meta-narrative. The world of the Metcaina. In designing the oceans of Pandora, we knew we had a massive challenge, explains Dylan Cole. For one, our director, James Cameron, knows more about the ocean than anyone. He's referring to not only Cameron's record-breaking solo dive to the Earth's lowest point in 2012, the Mariana Trench, where he documented in the 2014 National Geographic film James Cameron's Deep Sea Challenge, his actions, but also to his lifelong passion for the sea. Beyond even that, Cole's task involved creating an ecosystem that would have shaped the Metcaina clan's entire way of life. The characters themselves are a slightly different shade of blue than the Omaticaya, and they have a different physiology, with large hands, wider chests and rib cages, and thick protuberances of cartilage beneath the skin, almost like fins, strakes, that extend down the sides of their arms and legs to help them swim. They also have wider tails to help propel their bodies through the water, explains Cameron. The Metcaina clan, the reef people, have adapted to ocean life, so they look quite pronouncedly different. The Metcaina village was designed to evoke a feeling of idyllic life on the reef. And just as the Omaticaya had their sacred places in the rainforest, the Metcaina have the cove of the ancestors, where their spirit tree stands. It needed to feel underwater and exotic, but also call back to the Tree of Souls, Cole says, referring to the giant willow tree that was attacked by RDA forces in Avatar. We kept the idea of a tree with glowing magenta tendrils and fronds like exotic kelp. The Metcaina have a unique and spiritual relationship with the Tulkun, a species of sentient whale-like creatures that can grow to 300 feet long, explains Cameron. The conceit is that the Tulkun culture and the Na'vi culture are joined together with music, with singing, with dance. The Metcaina, for example, would do tattoo patterns on the Tulkun that will express their family story. Adult Tulkun who have gone through their coming-of-age ceremony have tattooed bodies and tattooed fins, just as the Metcaina, as teenagers get their first tattoos as well. The character of Payakan is an adolescent Tulkun who befriends Jake and Neytiri's son Lo'ak. Though, like the Na'vi teen, Payakan also is something of an outcast. The two communicate using sign language developed specially by actor and deaf advocate C.J. Jones for the production of the film. They're both essentially misunderstood teenagers that aren't accepted, so they become pals out in the wild of the ocean, says Cameron. Among the other aquatic creatures are the ilu, a frisky, playful mammalian species that Cameron describes as a cross between a biplane version of a manta ray fused onto the long neck of a plesiosaur with the canard wings of a European jet fighter. Cole thought of them as the movie's answer to the ikran, the species of dragon-like aerial predators spotlighted in Avatar. We wanted the personality of a dolphin or a seal, something very fun, but they have teeth and can be scary when they need to be, says the production designer. By contrast, the skimwing is amphibious. It has a gill structure, but can also breathe at the surface of the water. The skimwing, or tsurak, is described as a warrior's mount, meaning it's more aggressive, it's more dangerous, it's faster, Cameron says. The design was inspired in part by the flying fish, but with a very different head shape and bright Pandoran wings, colored in a basic black and orange pattern with some white. The design doesn't just look cool, Cole says. It needs to function as if it were real. The design can't just look cool. It needs to function as if it were real. The world of the RDA. When the humans return to Pandora, they have only one goal in mind, utter domination. Traveling aboard a fleet of ISVs, short for interstellar vehicles, led by the Manifest Destiny, the heavily armed RDA has replaced the habitation modules that once held scientists and candidates for the Avatar program with sling loads which carry heavy equipment, military vehicles, and machinery. The ISV's enormous engines burn the native landscape to the ground as they descend through the air. It's a hostile takeover, Normandy Beach sort of moment, explains production designer Bryn Proctor. This beautiful 20-mile-wide radius of forest has been reduced to a wasteland of burning lumber. Proctor designed the sling load itself as a giant industrial structure, a cross between an oil rig and an office building, standing 30 stories tall. It's got these shock-absorbing legs because it has to be dropped down onto the planet. At the bottom of this 30-story tower, there's a giant ramp that opens up, and out of it comes a whole series of construction vehicles and AMP suits and people. All that equipment is used in the construction of the RDA's base of operations, a sprawling city called Bridgehead. It's a full-blown industrial port, says Proctor. There's refining of unobtainium, refining of fossil fuels. Jim wanted to feel like a frontier, wanted it to feel like a frontier boomtown, infinite construction, like ants toiling and building. In addition to a fleet of attack aircraft, the RDA also has in its arsenal the monstrous yet notably aerodynamic Sea Dragon, a 400-feet-long ship that can lift itself out of the water to skim the surface of the ocean at speeds of 140 knots. The Sea Dragon carries with it smaller vessels, all designed to assist in the hunting of Tulkun and defense. The lethal armada includes Mako attack subs armed with torpedoes, which hang like bombs ready to drop out of the water through the belly of the hull. Also on board are underwater crab suits, the film's answer to Avatar's AMP suit. The crab suit is like an oversized mechanical deckhand that can do all the heavy-duty jobs in and out of the water, says Cameron. In the same way that an actual crab can go into coral and plant and scuttle its way through, half skimming, half grabbing onto things, this can do the same. When it's walking onto the deck, it's walking on its knuckles, but in the water, it has a slight prehensile ability to pull those toes out and grab onto kelp and other objects. The Sea Dragon also carries on it a host of surface boats, including the Matador, a high-speed forward command support and harpoon platform, and several picadors, which are used for short-range patrol and defensive response roles. Underwater performance capture. For Avatar: The Way of Water, Cameron and his team had to go back to the proverbial drawing board to determine how to capture performances underwater, something that had never been done before. The key to it was to actually shoot underwater and at the surface of the water so people were swimming properly, getting out of the water properly, diving in properly, Cameron says. It looks real because the motion was real, and the emotion was real. The behind-the-scenes team constructed an enormous tank at the Manhattan Beach Studios, where Cameron and Landau's production company Lightstorm is housed. The tank could hold enough water to allow the filmmaker to replicate real-world oceanic conditions. Standing 120 feet long, 60 feet wide, and 30 feet deep, and holding more than 250,000 gallons of water, the massive tank functioned as the film's underwater volume, a performance capture stage, as performance capture stages are known. That became our complete Swiss Army system, Cameron says. We could do waves breaking on the shore and have people trying to get out of the water while they are getting hit by waves. We could create wave interaction with the creatures and people surfacing, getting hit by a wave and trying to say their lines and trying to breathe at the same time. A propeller system dubbed the racetrack, which consisted of 2 6-foot diameter ship propellers, was used to drive the current in the tank. It was only a 10-knot current, but we were able to make it look much faster for the film, Cameron says. For the performance capture technology to work underwater, however, the water had to be clear. So although Cameron had initially thought the crew photographing the actors might be able to wear scuba gear while shooting in the tank, the breathing apparatus created disturbances in the water. You can't have a lot of air bubbles, the filmmaker explains. Every one of those air bubbles is a little wiggling mirror, and the system that's trying to read all the marker dots on the actor's body so it can capture their motion can't tell the difference between a marker dot and a bubble. That only left one option. Everybody who was working in the tank was holding their breath, Cameron says. If there was somebody down there holding a light, they were holding their breath. If they were operating a camera, they were holding their breath. The actors, of course, had to be holding their breath. To help them give compelling performances underwater, the cast studied free diving with internationally recognized expert Kirk Crack. The actors really enjoyed it, says Cameron, noting that while every member of the ensemble proved adept at free diving, Winslet took to the water with astonishing ease. Says Cameron, Kate enjoyed the freedom of being able to express herself underwater. She was able to do a static breath hold for something like 7 minutes and 20 seconds. I've been a free diver for 50 years, and I think the longest I've ever held my breath was 5.5 minutes. What we essentially wound up with was a volume for underwater and a separate volume for the air, Cameron continues. Those two volumes had to sit right on top of one another, with only an inch between. So the computer's taking data from one volume, data from the other volume, and in real time, is integrating all that information and showing me, on my virtual camera, people coming and going, swimming up, getting out onto a dock, or diving in and swimming underwater. It was two completely separate methods of capture being fused together. Obviously, the software to do that took quite a while to get worked out, but the end result was amazing. Performance capture for Avatar: The Way of Water began in September of 2017 and ran for roughly 18 months, with Cameron and the cast working on scenes for all four of the sequels. For the actors, it's a very pure process, says Cameron. They're not distracted by anything. We just roll. Sometimes we'll record for 10 to 12 minutes straight. It's a creative sandbox, and I find as a director, I'm much more attuned to the actors' emotional states. After Cameron and the editorial team picked the best performances for each moment of a given scene, Cameron then employed a revolutionary virtual camera to create the specific shots. The virtual camera allowed the director to shoot scenes within his computer-generated world, just as if he were filming at a real location or on a Hollywood soundstage. Through this virtual camera, the director would see not Zoe Saldana, Sam Worthington or Sigourney Weaver, but their giant blue characters in the world of Pandora. I could see everybody, where they're supposed to be, above or below the water, and I could talk to them over the diver address system. They were acting to real-time direction based on what I was seeing on the virtual camera, Cameron says. Once the virtual camera shots were edited into cut sequences, the shots and performances were delivered to the visual effects experts at Peter Jackson's Academy Award-winning visual effects powerhouse Weta FX in New Zealand, who had helped Cameron breathe life into Avatar's Avatar and Na'vi characters. Under the direction of senior visual effects supervisor Joe Letteri, a four-time Oscar winner famed for his innovative work on the CG characters including Gollum and King Kong, the Weta FX artisans worked to preserve the nuances of every performance. Collaborating with Letteri was Lightstorm's own Oscar winner Richard Bainham. The two together pushed the VFX artists to be utterly truthful to the actors' work. Of course, the artists needed to add the subtle movements of the Na'vi tails and ears, which the actors could not do themselves. But even in those cases, the goal was always to remain consistent with the emotions created by the cast. We look at every actor and every performance at a frame-by-frame level to make sure it matches, says Letteri. To me, it always comes down to the characters and the ability to be with them, to be in the moment with them, to see their performances, to understand what they're feeling and what they're going through. That emotional connection is always what you're going for, adds Cameron. What we're interested in with performance capture is the totality of the performance. Physical, emotional, facial, the eyes, everything. What the actor did in that moment is sacred. For Avatar, the visual effects team had developed an image-based facial performance capture system, using a single standard definition head rig camera to accurately record the smallest nuances of the actors' facial performances. The rig faced towards the actors' faces, and the camera recorded facial expression and muscle movements to a degree never before possible. Most importantly, the camera recorded eye movement, which had not been the case with prior systems. The head rig system allowed actors' facial performances to be captured with unprecedented clarity and precision. For Avatar: The Way of Water and its sequels, the head rig was updated with two high-definition cameras designed to capture an even higher fidelity and more nuanced performance. Having that performance as detailed as possible helps us make sure that that's what we see in the final shots. Working in concert with the team at Lightstorm, Weta FX not only needed to create photoreal characters who would be engaging and emotional, but they also had to create digitally, at an unprecedented level, the world of Pandora. Every plant, every tree, every rock needed to be created and rendered in the VFX team's computers. Significant breakthroughs in lighting, shading, and rendering allowed them to complete shots with far more complexity than ever before, given the ubiquity of water in the scenes. More than 5 years of research and development went into inventing new software and methodology for the sequel. The whole movie doesn't take place in and under the water, but a big proportion of it does, Cameron says. We had to figure out how water moves when a huge creature moves tons of water with its fin, or when the tiniest raindrop lands on someone's forehead, trickles down into their eyebrow and down to their face. It is an incredibly complex problem, but it's not like we were starting from scratch. We were doing water simulations back on Titanic, but it's taking it not just to the next level, but up 5 levels. The beauty of it is, you can solve water for the first movie. You can solve water for this movie. You can do all water anytime until the end of time. So these tools become incredibly important for the effects industry at large. cinematography and costume design. Most of the live-action scenes in Avatar were shot in Wellington, New Zealand, and for the sequels, Cameron was determined to return to the country. We enjoyed the experience of shooting there so much on the first film. Just the quality of the workmanship of the sets and the props. There's real pride in what they do, Cameron says. Still, Cameron brought with him a team of top-flight artists, including cinematographer Russell Carpenter. Our lighting that we did in the live-action scenes had to merge seamlessly with whatever environment we were in, whether it was a dense jungle, whether it was underwater, whether it was in the RDA facility, says Carpenter, notes Landau of the cinematographer. When you have a combination of live-action and CG, one of the most difficult things is the interactive lighting. We were also shooting this in 3D at high dynamic range at 48 frames per second. Russell had to embrace all of those things. He also worked closely to ensure that the lighting complemented the film's established color palette. Jim wants, well, everything, the color, the lighting, the contrast, to affect the viewer, to have the neurons in our visual system in our brain stimulated in a certain way, Carpenter says. That's why we have this attention to color, attention to detail, attention to camera movement, to help with that sense of immersion. Landau adds, Carpenter's work started long before the live-action filming. We wanted Russell's eye to be the cinematography lens that also defined the look of the CG scenes. Furthering that sense of immersion are the richly detailed costumes designed by Oscar winner Deborah L. Scott. Scott approached every costume as if it told its own story. What role does this character play in the movie? In their society? The costumes for the newly introduced reef people needed to be unique to their culture and to be grounded in the resources of their surrounding environment. A very rare aside from me, I'll mention here that all designs, clothing, items, artifacts, weapons, maquettes for the Avatar films aren't simply for reference, but I believe that going forward, that the material that they're made out of will be able to endure for many museum and exhibition purposes. So constructing 9-foot tall maquettes or mannequins, so to speak, to display this work as part of museums or faux museums, pretending to be or essentially alluding to in-world accurate museums, I believe that's something very applicable by Deborah's incredible work. So there's no sense of them overkill in designing something before in real life, before scanning it into a computer. I think it has multiple uses. So, although the vast majority of Na'vi costumes were only going to be realized digitally on screen by Weta FX, many of the costumes and much of the jewelry were fabricated as real, tangible items. One of the reasons that we've made the garments to completion is that the motion of the garment cannot be understood without having a whole piece, explains Scott. If something's heavy or feathery or light or stringy or fringy, the way these things move in air, standing in a breeze underwater, you really have to have the sample to see what happens to it. Says Leteri, the costumes on this film are much more involved than what we had on the first film. Costumes are simulated because they're physical. If someone walks and moves their arm, the cloth folds and wrinkles and bends with them. If their costume is made out of lots of little pieces like beads and strings or feathers or woven bits, that all has to go through this really detailed physical simulation to make it behave as if it were a real piece of cloth. If we wanted Weta FX to make a costume look real, we needed to give them a standard to ascribe to, says Landau. The beautiful creations Deb designed and built with the incredible artisans at Weta Workshop provided exactly that. Gosh, I would love to speak with Deb on the show. Sorry, I had to say that as well. One of the most intriguing pieces that emerged from early development was the ceremonial cloak worn by Cliff Curtis's Metkaina Oloektan Tonowari. It's a huge signifying piece for any character of his stature, Scott says. The initial conception came from some black and white etchings that I had found of flora and fauna. Scott took inspiration from nature, drawing on the colors of the Papua shell, which is every color in the rainbow from green to purple to blue, silver, all of that, she says, and the sunrise. The feathers inside his cloak go from pale yellow all the way down to orange, says the costume designer. They're super vibrant, just like a festive bird he gets to show off. An immersive and emotional theatrical spectacle. In all of his films, James Cameron creates an immersive experience in which audiences will feel like they're alongside the characters on their adventures. But that's never been truer than in the case of Avatar: The Way of Water, which stands as a new creative zenith for the singularly talented filmmaker who yet again pushes the boundaries of cinematic storytelling, By expertly utilizing enhanced 3D technology, Cameron transports filmgoers inside the narrative, enabling them to truly experience the richly detailed environments of Pandora and allowing them the opportunity to traverse its majestic terrain alongside brave and bold heroes, Jake and Neytiri. "We make movies for the big screen," says producer John Landau. "Why do people turn to entertainment today? To escape. And you can only escape so far on your mobile device or on a home big screen. But when you go to the theater, you get lost in the images on screen, the characters, and the world of that movie. There's nothing like it. The experience is even more transporting given the stunning imagery and compelling story Cameron and his collaborators were able to conjure using groundbreaking technology, offering audiences a breathtaking and heart-pounding escape like they've never seen before. With 3D, high dynamic range, high frame rate, we're able to present a higher quality image today than we could on Avatar by far," Landau says. "It goes beyond what was possible before, and we do all of this to service the narrative storytelling. It's a window into another world." Concludes Cameron, "You go into a movie theater and you're being transported to a fictional fantasy world. The more you can suspend your disbelief, the more fun it is. There's almost a contract between the movie and the audience. We're all just going to join hands and skip off to Pandora together. It's going to be fun." So from here, it goes into about each of the cast members, Sam Worthington, Zoe, talking about their extensive filmographies, Sigourney Weaver, Stephen Lang, Kate Winslet, who has a very extensive one, Cliff Curtis, Joel David Moore, C.H. Pounder, Edie Falco, Brendan Cowell, Jermaine Clement. What I'll say here is if you have a look at, like, for example, Edie Falco, she'll describe that she plays, General Ardmore, or rather, it doesn't describe that who they're playing, but it alludes to things coming up, like will next be seen starring opposite Brian Cox in the new Lion HBO Max feature, The Parenting. So there you go. For what it's worth, my speculation is that Edie will also stretch into further sequels as well. She's a massive get for the team and for the cast and crew performance-wise. So yes, going into details about the young ones as well. So Jermaine Clement, Brennan Cowell, Brighton Dalton, Jamie Flatters, Trinity Jolie Bliss, Jack Champion, Bailey Bass, and Philip Geljo. Then we have also about the filmmakers, James Cameron, John Landau, Rick Jaffa, Amanda Silva, excellent Planet of the Apes co-creators, and I cannot wait for Kingdom of Planet of the Apes. That's going to be great for the Planet of the Apes podcast we do. Josh Friedman, Shane Salerno, David Valdez, Richard Bainham, Russell Carpenter, Dylan Cole, Ben Proctor, Stephen Rifkin, David Brenner, John Refua, Joe Letteri, Deborah L. Scott, Simon Franklin as well. So I'm really looking forward to Simon's score. So that, my friends, is the production note. The production notes for Avatar, The Way of Water. For a little bit of background, you may have heard during recording, I myself am now composed entirely of water because to ensure the ideal recording conditions for you, I locked myself in my car, which happened to be parked on the roof on a very warm Australia day. So I am absolutely bathed in sweat right now, but it was worth it. I had to open the door at some point when we were describing the Manifest Destiny, the vessel, and all of that sort of RDA stuff. So I figured letting in a bit of incidental industrial sounding work would fit in from that point of view. But this is a field recording, as I'm sure you've been able to tell. And thank you for bearing with in terms of the shifts with the recording formats. So as a bit of a preview, as I tie this one off, so episode 33 will be the first episode we record after the release of Avatar The Way of Water. So that's, like, yeah, I suppose in addition to that other beautiful dream come true element of the production notes, I'm having all kinds of amazing throwback memories to, I think I read the Dragonheart one. I think I read, like, there's such an emotional, folks, I don't know if I'm emphasizing it enough, just the coziness of reading the production notes of a movie is something I'll always cherish, and I cannot believe that I just read the production notes of Avatar The Way of Water, and sharing it with you right now. So I feel like you've all been retroactively inserted into my past as, like, schoolmates and friends that have come with me who know exactly how I'm feeling right now. So
And as you can see, look at that. It's just a beautiful, just start to finish kind of little capturing of the production. I have very fun memories for the Jurassic Park one. And I've mentioned multiple times how right now feels like we're on the eve of a Jurassic Park level, filmmaking art form event with all the innovations that were done for that in terms of really breaking CG into this brand new realm that expanded out into the industry. And that also, folks, is what I want to say about an era of conveyor belt throwing stuff at the wall and cookie cutter filmmaking. These films which actually stop and pause and say, no, from this film onwards we're drawing a line in the Metcaina sand, and from after this film there will be new tools available for all filmmakers. So those big shifts. Avatar did that itself 13 years ago, and that's how we got things like Thanos, etc. And this also will do the same for filmmaking. So it's basically like a film comes along that is treated as a technology opportunity, as an expo, and only filmmakers with the influence and clout and ambition, first and foremost ambition and passion and dedication of James Cameron and his crew, Joe Letteri, everybody, these amazing people whom we all hope to have on the podcast as the years go by. That's how an event like this happens. So look, it's been so wonderful for the past however long it's been since at least 2019 when I first posted, or in 2018 we started the countdown, something like 978 days, something like that, on Instagram. We're now 9 days. So from 900 to 9 days, there's even a chance that some people decided to torture themselves a little bit by listening to some of those early episodes, but who are completionists and may even have arrived at this point after listening to, episodes 1 through, 32, which is this one. And all I want to say is thank you personally. The Topic Podcast Network is about looking at this material across all of these universes we love, from a heart-led place, an empathy-led place, but also very much led by passion and going a bit against the grain of what a lot of other channels do, which focus on certain common components more often, like, the cast, for example. But for us, we really do, as starting with, John Roschel, the font designer, Garrett Warren, the second unit director, we want to bring in everyone. So everyone you read, including my little moment where I had to take a moment to just manifest speaking with Deb, that's absolutely my passion, is to have these be these, hopefully to live long after me as well, and to be operated long after me as well, these repositories of the smallest of stories, even for who has helped bring these worlds to life. So yes, thank you so much. I will speak with you all live. We'll be streaming live right after we see the film. Ray and I will come home. Everything will be set up. That live stream will be waiting for us. So essentially, as soon as we get through the door, we're going to jump onto the live stream and give our thoughts and our feelings and our impressions of the film. That will be episode 33, which also is 3.3. That's the billion. 3.3 billion, this film. Okay? You'll heard those articles that I read out about Cameron saying, and again, it's not the money is not the objective, but he's not an idiot. He knows that when you push things this far, when you spend the time that it took to crack the story and make it universal, make it really good, make it so organically lead authentically to the point where it just feels like you make a sequel so good that the original feels incomplete without it. That's the goal of a sequel. That's what Terminator did. That's what Aliens did. Alien feels incomplete without its sequel to a degree. You can say it's a self-contained, this saying that each of those avatars is going to be self-contained, but that is the essence of a worthwhile sequel, is that it completely organically complements, and you can very much say, inarguably, that it enhances the original and feels like the original is incomplete without these sequels. So that's the goal here. And with the technology that's being applied, with the, despondency shedding, despondency melting, which will happen, we will get rid of a lot of apathy that has been garnered from a past decade or so of ups and downs politically, ecologically, we could even say, with COVID, with the war in Ukraine, with the US political situation stuff that got really, really intense in 2020, with all of that. This is going to be, as John and Jim have said, it's that let's go to Pandora together. Let's Let's feel that breeze on the Metcaina beach. Let's immerse ourselves in this 3+ hour story. And as you read, the level of detail 100% merits, 110% merits repeat viewings. I've mentioned that, I guess I can announce it here, I will be at Hoyt's from the 14th to the 18th. That's 5 straight sessions every single day at 6 p.m. at Hoyt's Woden. If you're at those extreme screen, look for the guy in the Avatar shirt. That's the Avatar podcast. I'll be podcasting every night with audience members. And there's also going to be a giveaway with 10 free passes as well to help bring more people in. And again, this would do, it would reach 3.3 absolutely on its own. Again, you know, word of mouth is the ultimate barometer. It'll surpass and continue always to surpass anything that hashtags or algorithms or anything like that can do. So that's this level of filmmaking we're talking about. However, my natural, again, that it flows from me, like irrepressibly, cannot help but do this, is to feel this allyship and this kinship and a true resonance with Jim and John's endeavor of not letting this art form slip into, and as I've argued for interactive as well, don't let it slip into the recreation. Just like go see the movies, turn your brain off. And it's just this cookie cutter kind of same, you know, merry-go-round of the same old, which it has truly been, especially for the past decade or so. So go to these things and create these things from a place of innovation, of evolution. And if we make that shift in our minds as a human race as well, then we won't sit in apathy or in despondency or in inertia about our environment as well, about our indigenous cultures and about our art forms. So in all three of these senses, it's this beautiful, beautiful call to awakening. Okay. So, I love you all. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Nati Kameya. I will see you after Avatar The Way of Water, where our journey really continues. But in this instance, with this new era of Avatar has truly begun. 10 years from here, let's go, and even beyond after that. Be well, everybody, and until next time, bye for now. This was a presentation by the Topic Podcast Network, a 100% community-supported endeavor across multiple outlets, created by Albert Kesser. If you are interested in participating in the Topic Podcast Network in any capacity, please like, share, subscribe, and check out our Patreon and Ko-fi accounts. In addition, you can send in an email to topicpodcastnetwork@gmail.com, and you can also chime in with me, Albert Kesser, across all my social outlets, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and at albertkesser.com. I really, really appreciate you giving your time today, and thank you so much for being who you are and doing what you do. Bye now.